Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Also, while you're over there, you can check out the events page. The events page, you'll find out where all kinds of different 1517 speakers are going to be. And one of the things you'll notice on that events page are city events for Houston and Las Vegas. We're going to be in Houston in February, Las Vegas in March. We'd love to hang out with you. All the information is over there, and you can register. Here's the thing, guys. Both those events are free. If you're in the great nation of Texas, come on down to Houston. Hang out. Chad will be there. I'll be there. A whole bunch of other folks. If you are in that, if you're living in that Sin City, well, we got you covered. We're going to be in Las Vegas. That's free, too. Come hang out. Chad, we are also going to be in Europe. We're going to be in the great country of Germany, birthplace of the Reformation, in May of next year.
I'm like trying to keep my wife from already beginning planning packing. You know, she's like looking months in advance.
Checking out like what the weather's like in Germany. Right.
Yeah, that's how excited she is.
I think the weather, as I understand it, the weather in Germany is gray.
Yeah, that's kind of my impression too.
That's how I get it. Our German listeners can correct me, but that's how I understand it. But hey, we're excited. It's the Great Freedom Conference. I'll put a link in the show notes. So if you're one of our European listeners, which we know we got a lot of those, then we would love to see you. Chad and I will both be there. Eric Sorensen will be there. Scott Keith, come on out. Registration is open, so register for that and come see us. And we'd love to hang out with you in the Germany is probably like much cooler to us than it is if you live in Europe, I suppose, because to us as Lutherans, I mean, it's a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like that with any place you live. You know, when people come to visit us, they're like, oh, we got to go see the Alamo. And I'm like, yeah, I've seen it several times.
This is a funny
story. We'll take you there. You know, we'll be the tour guides for the day. But yeah, once you've been once, it's like, okay.
Well, this is what's funny. The Alamo. This is what's funny. We're going to Germany. And of course, I'm planning a little trip down to Wittenberg.
Of course.
Because I just got to go. But here's an example of how this works. So if you go to Germany, I got to go there. I lived in Arizona for over a year, right there in Phoenix. And people would be like, dude, what's the Grand Canyon like? And I'm like, I don't know. I never went. And people will travel like great, great distances to go see the Grand Canyon. But because it was local, I never went.
Yeah, I live in Texas. I've been there 3 times. Well, you just got to plan a trip back. You cannot not see the Grand Canyon.
I guess so. It is funny because I talked to some of the German guys over there, and there were actually a couple of them that were like, "Yeah, I'll be honest, I've never been down to Wittenberg," and that just like blew my mind. But then I realized, I never went to the Grand Canyon, so it's kind of like that.
Yeah, that is the way we are. Well, yeah, that's definitely on our to-do list.
It is. It's gonna happen.
Yeah. Got to be there.
All right. So where are we at in Joshua? We left with Joshua interacting with an interesting character.
Yeah, we did. We did. We were in the last 3 verses of chapter 5 of Joshua, and it's a good transition point into what's going to follow, which is all about Jericho. So we're going to pick up with a couple of items from Joshua 5, 13 through 15 that we didn't get around to that I think are significant to help us understand a little bit more about who this is and why he appears the way that he does to Joshua, and how that compares with other Christophanies or theophanies from the Old Testament. So just kind of recap, Joshua is met by this man. That's the way he's first described. This is an ish, which is the Hebrew word for just kind of a generic word for man. Joshua is close to Jericho, and he lifts up his eyes, he looks, and behold, there's this guy, and he's standing opposite him. But he's not just standing there, but he's in a military posture with a military weapon in his hand. So he's got a sword, and not just a sword like on his belt in its sheath, but it is drawn in his hand. So of course, I mean, if you're Joshua, the first thing that you're going to think is, this guy's coming for me, or at least you're going to wonder if the guy's coming for you. So Joshua says, basically, are you for us or for our adversaries? We talked about his response last time when he says, no or neither. And Dan, you talked about that quite well, about how the position that this commander of the Lord's armies was taking with respect to the Israelites as well as the rest of the people of the land of Canaan. So he says, neither. And then he says, I have come as the, my translation has, the captain of the host of the Lord, or it could be the commander of the Lord's armies. So that word that's translated here in my version is captain, in some other versions as commander. The word is a real simple Hebrew word, sar. We see it, for instance, in Isaiah chapter 9. It's the sar shalom as one of the descriptions of the Messiah. He's the prince of peace. So in Isaiah 9, it's translated as prince. But it's kind of a general Hebrew word that's used a whole lot of times, hundreds of times in the Old Testament, typically to describe some sort of military commander, or at least a commander of some sort. So here he's described as the commander of the host of the Lord, or the armies of the Lord. So of course, he's not only appearing as a soldier, as a military commander, but he identifies as one as well. Well, immediately, Joshua realizes that he's not dealing here with just a regular guy, but with somebody else. And he's going to find out more about him as the conversation goes on. But you can tell Joshua realizes this because he falls on his face to the earth. He bows down. So he takes the typical posture that Israelites take when they're either in the presence of a king, but especially when in the presence of the Lord, or at least of the Lord's messenger. That is, just by way of reminder, in the Old Testament, worship is always a very bodily activity. It's, you know, with some Christian churches today, worship still is a very bodily activity. I mean, you got everything from bowing to making the sign of the cross to raising your hands to clapping. I mean, there's all sorts of bodily activities that go on even in the church today, but it was certainly that way in the Old Testament. In fact, I expect, you know, when we think about someone bowing down to the ground, I think today we actually, the image that immediately comes to mind is Muslims at prayer.
Right.
When they get down on their knees and they put their head, but that's actually a very modern way of picturing how the Israelites themselves would have worshiped.
Well, that's a fairly Abrahamic thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, Abraham does that too. A lot of the patriarchs did. You see this throughout the Old Testament, really. Especially any time in which God makes an appearance, that's just people's automatic reaction. They fall to the ground. They place their face to the ground. And this is the way, this is the very posture of worship or of adoration or of humility, kind of all together. And then Joshua says, what has my Lord to say to his servant? Now, at this point, Joshua's language doesn't necessarily betray his complete understanding of who this is. So maybe Joshua himself isn't totally sure. I mean, this could be an angel, right? We don't know. But when it says, what has my Lord to say to his servant, that's not Yahweh. In the Hebrew, it's just the word, the kind of the general word for a Lord or a master. So Adon is the Hebrew there. So maybe he thinks he's just an angel. Maybe he thinks he's something else. But we're going to find out in just a second who he really is. Verse 15, this captain of the Lord's host goes on to say, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And then Joshua does so. Now, let me just take two more verses to kind of complete who this is. So I'm going to jump into chapter 6 just for verses 1 and 2. Now, Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. And the Lord, that's Yahweh, and the Lord, Yahweh, said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand. So this is one of these cases where it's very important that you completely ignore chapter divisions. Because if you were to read those last few verses of chapter 5 and stop, you wouldn't be exactly sure who this was. I mean, this very well could be an archangel or some other angel. There's a very strong suggestion it's somebody more. But when you read on into those first two verses of chapter 6, you see that the one who is speaking to Joshua is more than an ish, more than just a man. He's more than just a captain or a general. He actually is Yahweh himself. So this fits with, especially with Exodus chapter 3 and the appearance of the angel slash Lord to Moses in the burning bush, because we have the same kind of language it's used. First of all, in Exodus 3, we're not exactly sure who this is, but then as the story goes on, the one in the burning bush identifies himself as God or as Yahweh. Same thing happens here. First, you have a man, then you have him identified as the captain, and then finally, in chapter 6, you have him identified as Yahweh himself. And you have the same kind of language repeated with regard to the removal of sandals, because the place where first Moses is standing and then second Joshua is standing is holy ground. And it's holy, of course, because God is now making his appearance, and because he himself is holy, where he appears is holy. So both of these should be read in tandem, Exodus 3, Joshua 5, and those opening two verses of chapter 6, because this is actually the same person appearing in both these places. This is one of these many Christophanies in the Old Testament, many appearances of the Word or the Son or the messenger of the Father. And what I think is fascinating about this particular one in comparison with Exodus chapter 3 is you get the impression, at least I do, that when God makes his appearance, he is to some extent making an appearance that corresponds to the situation he's in and the person that he's addressing. So for instance, when he appears in Exodus 3 to Moses, he appears to Moses while Moses is shepherding his flock, and he appears to him at Mount Sinai, the very mountain that Moses, of course, will later take the Israelites to. So this kind of sets the whole tone of the conversation and of the mission that God sends Moses on. So God appears while Moses is shepherding because he's going to call him from shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law to shepherd the people of Israel. And he appears to him at Mount Sinai because, of course, it's that mountain that Moses will later shepherd the people of Israel. Now, here, it's a very different situation because he appears to Joshua, of course, not on a mountaintop, but he appears to him by Jericho, which, of course, is a city they're about to attack. And he appears to him as a warrior, as the commander of the Lord's armies, because he is in heaven, kind of what Joshua is in a much more limited way on earth. Joshua is the earthly commander of the armies of Israel, and Christ is the commander of the armies of heaven. So in both those cases, you can see sort of the Lord accommodating his appearance to the situation and to the person that he's addressing. It's one more of these many appearances of Christ in the Old Testament, which affirm that Christ was always with his people, always in some way making his presence known, being with them, leading them, guiding them. He wasn't waiting for his incarnation to finally come down from heaven. He came down from heaven all the time, just not as a flesh and blood human like he did beginning with his incarnation. So anyway, there's lots of cool stuff there in those last few verses of Joshua 5 and those couple of verses of Joshua 6.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably good if you are Joshua and you're about to go do sort of the first thing. You're about to have this first big act under your leadership. This is going to be a nerve-wracking thing. I mean, you've had Moses this whole time and you're about to go do this thing. And I mean, I'm sure Joshua believes that this is what God wants them to do, but it's kind of nice when God shows up and affirms this for you. I mean, this has to be good for the confidence.
Yeah, I would think Joshua's confidence level would just shot through the roof.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so what you said kind of fits in with this whole narrative about Joshua. Well, everything really up to these first six chapters, all of this is big first-time stuff. First time in the Holy Land, and the first big battle coming up. First real, if you don't think about the crossing of the Jordan, this is the first real big thing that Joshua is going to be doing. And that's one of the reasons that so much time is spent in these first few chapters on these opening events, because this is kind of setting the stage for what is going to follow. We won't hear nearly as much about some of the other battles, some of the other victories, and at least one defeat, which will be coming up relatively soon. But a lot of time is spent on Jericho, because this sets the precedent for what's going to follow. So we have a focus on Joshua's new leadership, upon Israel's new status in the Holy Land, and now, once we get to chapter 6, about their first big confrontation and how God is going to use this to set the pattern for what's going to happen in the coming battles, and to teach Israel something about, to remind them, I guess you could say, ritually, what is really going on with these battles and who is actually giving them the victory against all their enemies. So let's move on. So Joshua 6, verses 1 and 2, I already read. We'll pick up here again with the words in verse 2, where this commander has identified himself as Yahweh. So Yahweh says to Joshua, "Look, I've given Jericho into your hand with its king and its valiant warriors. And then he goes on to describe this well-known, kind of, when you step back from it, very, very weird way of preparing to take the city. And one of my earliest memories from Sunday school, it might be my earliest memory from Sunday school, is learning about Joshua chapter 6. I even had like this little cassette tape, this little book. I can remember as a little kid, I like listened to these songs. I wish I remembered what the song was. Some kid song about Joshua and Jericho and marching around the city. And I remember being fascinated by this particular story. And so it's like my earliest memory of what happens here. But of course, when I was a little kid, I didn't stop to think of how weird this is. I mean, the whole thing is so strange.
Oh, my memory is of this is a little weirder than that. I was a part of a Christian youth group back in the day. And right before the day before the first day of school, this group decided that they would march around the school 7 times and pray, because that seemed like a good thing to do. And I remember even then thinking, wait, are we about to take this school over?
Yeah. Did you have like trumpets?
Like, are we about to invade this? What are we doing? I mean, some people are very familiar with this concept of prayer walking. But there's very much an attachment to Jericho, like Joshua and Jericho, like, hey, we're gonna march around the school 7 times praying. And I did think even then, like, at the end of the 7 times, isn't something that we really don't want to happen?
Yeah. It's like you're declaring war against the school.
Yeah, dude. I'll tell you what. Yeah, sometimes, you know, sometimes Christians get a little fruity.
yeah, they do.
So you think about felt boards when you hear this story. I think about marching around high schools.
Preparing for battle.
About to take this place for Jesus.
Take this place down. It is such an odd scene. I was reflecting more about it this morning when I was doing some preparation for this. And just, first of all, you got to ask, you know, why? I think that is maybe not always a question that we do ask of this, but why would God want them to do what they do? I mean, you've got a lot of other options, right? I suppose you could just attack the city, but there's really no practical reason to wait 7 days. And why, you know, why walk around that a total, if you count like the once a day for 6 days, and then, you know, the 7 times around it again. So I mean, like, yeah, 13 times of walking around this city, carrying the Ark of the Covenant and blaring the trumpets, but nobody else is saying a word. Why? I mean, that's some strange stuff going on.
Well, I think
there's a lot of other ways that it could have been done, in other words.
Yeah, I think there's probably like the reason that it happens, which is, if this is the way you do this, it prohibits you from taking any credit, because what they do, I mean, this is obviously God giving them the victory at the end of this. I mean, we'll see when we get there, but there's no way you could be like, man, we did it. Like, man, I tell you what, that was a great strategy. Like, we have done it. God ensures that the people know that this was, he won this victory for them.
Yeah, I think that's probably Like, of all the reasons, that's the main one.
Yeah, I think that's the main reason. A side effect of this is I think about, if I think about, like, I'm a resident of Jericho, and like I said last episode, they're all pent up in the city. I mean, some dude, like, the sea just, like, parted, and all these people marched across, and, I mean, Rahab said these guys are scared to death. The spies saw it. They're totally freaked out, melting hearts, the whole thing, right? So they're in the city, and then these freaks start marching around your city, carrying this, like, gold box, blowing trumpets, and they're just marching around it every day. Like, this has got to be the freakiest thing ever. If you're in that, you're like, because you don't know what, you have no idea what they're doing. Like, I mean, if this happened to you, you'd be like, what are these guys doing? Like, what is about to happen to us?
Yeah. That's like ancient psychological warfare going on there.
Oh, yeah. If someone's doing this, you have to think, if you're them, it seems like such a bold, confident thing to do. Like, these guys are toying, like, they're messing with us.
Yeah.
Like, this is very psychologically damaging, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. Yeah, there's, like, there's two things going on here. This is partly for the Israelites, but it's also partly for the Jerichoans, or whatever you call the people in Jericho. Yeah, I mean, if their hearts had already melted, well, I don't know what, like, the next stage after melting is, but there's not going to be anything left, in other words, once this happens. So they've got to be wondering throughout each day, what are they up to? What's their next plan? So, and of course, they won't find out until the seventh day. But I think it's part of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, if you brought this down to, like, a real practical level, say you were, like, in your house, like, you lived, like, out in the middle of nowhere, and you are in your house, and you're in there, and then, like, these 10 guys show up, and then once a day they march around your house with a box. This should be so freaky.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, that's what happens. Let me read these next few verses. We'll kind of get the whole picture here. And as I read them, listen for all the sevens. I think that's going to be significant here. So pick up here with verse 3. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, circling the city once. All right, you can do that for 6 days. Verse 4, also seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. And then on the seventh day, you shall march around the city seven times, and the priest shall blow the trumpets. Verse 5, and it shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up, every man straight ahead. So those are the instructions of this commander of the Lord of hosts, Yahweh, gives to Joshua. So one of the fascinating aspects of this, when you look at it in the context of the rest of the Old Testament, is just the number of times that seven is mentioned. So it's going to be a total of 7 days. You got seven priests who are carrying seven trumpets, and on the seventh day, they're going to march around the city seven times. So it's like he wants to make sure that you don't miss the significance of the number seven. And this fits in with a whole lot of other Old Testament stories and rituals that we've talked about on a number of occasions. You first of all encounter the theological significance of seven, of course, in the creation account, when the Lord rests on the seventh day. But then that seventh day and that seven number becomes the foundation for basically the whole festival liturgical calendar of the Israelites. So the seventh day, the Sabbath, you have the seventh year, or the sabbatical year, which is every seventh year. And then you have the Jubilee year, which is the year after seven Sabbaths of years, or 49 years. So you've got all kinds of significance related to the number seven, which is usually connected with something like completeness. And I suspect that's what's going on here. The idea is that God is going to bring about all sorts of completeness through this. He's going to give them a complete victory. He's going to completely demolish their foes. And through the course of this 7 days, he's going to teach them to trust completely in him, because he's the one who's going to be giving them this victory. So there's a whole lot going on there with the number seven. And maybe there's other reasons as well, but I think that's kind of the basic message behind all these recurrences of seven. It kind of fits within the broader pattern that you see from Genesis onward of the Lord doing things with the number seven.
You know, one of the things I've thought about, and this is probably a huge aside, but is that they do this for 7 days, which means, I don't know what day they started, but they did this on the Sabbath. Mm. And you, it shows you that how backwards the understanding of the Sabbath becomes, because this would be something that if you told the Pharisees, hey, let's march around the city for 7 days, they'd be like, well, there's at least one day where we can't do any marching, dude. You know that we can't. I mean, whatever God says, we still. I mean, He already said we can't do that. Obviously, there's a day, and maybe it is the seventh day. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, this seems how God would work, right? That you would start on a Sunday and you would end on the Sabbath, right? Now, we don't know that, but it would make sense that on the day of rest, that like all of those walls would come down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point to make. I think I mentioned this before on the podcast, but when I was a graduate student at Hebrew Union College, I took a whole class on the Sabbath, not like the Sabbath as a general topic, but one of the parts of the Talmud that's dedicated to the Sabbath. And I love the class just because of, it was very, very interesting, very educational, learned a lot about Jewish theology and in biblical interpretation and Hebrew and all that. But the thought that kept coming into my mind almost every time we got together and read a little bit of the Talmud about this was, my, this sounds just like the New Testament. Mm-hmm. I can understand why Jesus was constantly sparring with the Pharisees about the Sabbath day, because there were so many very minute rules about governing every imaginable kind of activity on the Sabbath day. So you can see how it had become just an oppressive day. Instead of it being created for man, it was like man was made for the Sabbath in this particular way of looking at it. So, I mean, there were just an amazing amount of restrictions with regard to what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath.
Yeah, I'm guessing they didn't include like, and then sometimes you'll march around the city seven times.
Yeah, I don't remember that being one of the things that was allowed. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if this, like you said, we don't know, but if the seventh day was actually the Sabbath day, and God was going to do on that Sabbath day something besides just having them kick back and stay inside their homes.
Yeah, well, it makes sense that because if you really understand the Sabbath, is the day where He's given man to rest, and so this is the day where. You know, I mean, what we would say is Sunday is like the day that we go and celebrate what the Lord has done. We go and receive, His gifts. Yeah, it makes sense that, the seventh day He'd be like, watch me work.
Yeah. And that's what He's about to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is going to be entirely the Lord's doing. All right. So let's pick up I know it seemed like we hadn't gone very far in the chapter. We're going to be able to actually summarize a lot of this, because what happens next is, so Joshua is given these instructions by the commander. And then in verse 6 and following, he then relays these same instructions to the people. So Christ tells Joshua what to do. Joshua turns around and goes back and tells the priest and the leaders of the army what they are to do. So basically you have this, you have a group of soldiers that go in front of the Ark of the Covenant. Then you have the priest, the seven priests who are blowing the trumpets. They're behind them. And then you have the guys who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And then you have a rear guard as well. And it's a little bit unclear whether all of the Israelites joined in every single march around the city. It's a little ambiguous. So I'll leave that up to you guys to decide whether you believe they are or not. But there's at least some ambiguity there. But either way, you've got at least these portions of the soldiers as the foreguard and the rear guard and the priest and the Ark of the Covenant, and they're marching around the city. And they do this, of course, for 6 days, once a day. And we have that summarized in those next few verses. So let's pick it up with verse 15 on the seventh day. So it comes about on the seventh day, they get up early, at the dawning of the day, and they march. Same thing, they march around the city, except this time they go seven times. And on the seventh time, I'm in verse 16 now, the seventh time when the priests blew the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city shall be under the ban. It shall be that all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab, the harlot, and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, keep yourselves from the things under the ban, lest you covet them and take some of the things under the ban, so you would make the camp of Israel accursed and bring trouble upon it." And then he goes on to say that all the silver, gold, bronze, iron are holy to God, and they're going into the treasury of the Lord. Now, I suspect Joshua gave these instructions to the people well before he said, "Shout." This is kind of a summary of what he had told the people. So when you shout, the walls are going to come down. But I want you to know something. When you go into the city, first of all, don't take any of the gold, silver, other metals, because those are going to belong to God. We're going to come back to that. That's significant because of what's going to happen in the next chapter. If we find out that at least one of the people did not heed these instructions, and disaster follows that. But anyway, it's put out there now as the instruction for the people, because all this stuff was considered to be harem in Hebrew, which is the word usually translated as like banned, or can be translated accursed. It kind of has a general meaning for everything that is no longer for human consumption. Either it's destroyed or it's given totally to the Lord if it's harem. So it goes on to say that that's what happens. So the people shout, the priests blow the trumpets, and when all this happens, the people shout this great shout, the walls go down flat, the people go up into the city, and everything is destroyed. And I mean everything. Verse 21 says, "They utterly destroyed," this is that Hebrew word harem again, "they put under the ban everything." So men, women, young and old, all the animals, the oxen, the sheep, the donkeys, everything was destroyed, except for Rahab and her family. So Joshua sends the two guys who knew Rahab into the city, and they bring not only Rahab out, but her parents and her brothers, and basically all of her relatives that she had brought into her house were saved, and then were placed, at least for a while, outside the camp of Israel. And then, excuse me, they were gradually integrated into the life of Israel. Come back to that in just a second. So what did they do with the city? Well, they did the city what they only did with two other cities, with Ai and with Hazor. They burned it. Most of the cities that they took, they kept, and they were able actually to use them as their own cities. But three of the cities, including Jericho, they burned to the ground. And then just kind of finish this out. Once the city was destroyed and burned, Joshua swears this oath before the Lord, saying, "Cursed is the man who rises up and builds the city of Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates." Now, it's going to be some time before this happens, about 500 years, but when Ahab is king, there's going to be a guy who actually does try and rebuild the city of Jericho, and this prophecy slash oath slash curse is fulfilled. And actually, there's a reference back to this, because when it happens, the guy not only loses his firstborn son, but he also loses his youngest son as well. And when that happens, this particular verse in Joshua is referenced. So we have Jericho taken, just like God promised, and just in the way that God promised it was going to happen. We have a complete destruction of everyone in it. And everything that was in it was supposed, everything, all the metals that were in it were supposed to be given to the Lord and be taken into the treasury of the Lord. Now, I want to point out a couple things here before we're out of time. We got about 5 minutes left. One of the ways I like to view chapter 6 is that it's kind of part of a pattern that we have established. I guess you could say it's the third part of a pattern that we've already seen a couple of other times in the scriptures. So if you look at the destruction of Jericho, with the crossing of the Red Sea, with the flood and Noah's Ark. All three of these together are giving us a preview of the final judgment and salvation. And they're all three connected in a multitude of ways. For instance, in each of these cases, those who are part of the redeemed are those who pass through water. So Israel passes through the Red Sea and are brought out safe. All of Noah's family pass through the waters of the sea safe on the ark. And Joshua, along with all the Israelites, pass through the waters of the Jordan River and enter into the promised land. So that's the first theme that unites all three of these, that those who pass through the waters are part of the redeemed of the Lord. The second thing that brings all three of these stories together is that there is always a man appointed by God to lead the people. So of course it's Noah with the flood, and it's Moses at the crossing of the Red Sea. And here it's Joshua with the destruction of Jericho. And then, of course, in each three of these cases, you have a destruction of those who are outside the kingdom of God. And that destruction is total. So there's a complete destruction of the world, except for Noah and his family. There's a complete destruction of Pharaoh and his Egyptian army. And here there's a complete destruction of the city of Jericho. And what's going on here, when you see all three of these stories together, is each of these is giving us a preview of what is going to happen when all of these stories come together in the capital T story of the Messiah, because he is the one who is, of course, the one appointed by God, just like Noah and Moses and Joshua. And his people are brought safely as part of the redeemed through water. That's the purpose of baptism. And we have the scriptures themselves talking about the connection between the crossing of the Red Sea and the flood and the Jordan in reference to baptism. And then secondly, you have these Old Testament stories kind of giving us a picture of eschatological destruction, of the end time destruction that's going to befall not just a city or not just an army, but like at the time of the flood, the whole world. So if people are bothered, the reason I bring this up is if people are troubled by this complete destruction of the city of Jericho, just keep in mind that it's part of a much larger pattern that we see throughout scriptures that is a picture of actually what's going to happen at the end of the world. This is a preview of God's eschatological judgment and salvation that's sketched out here for us already in the book of Joshua.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable why this stuff bothers people. I'd be lying if I said that sometimes when you read this, it's not troubling. And what you have to understand is, in at least scripturally, when God deals with evil, he deals with it in absolute finality. I mean, he just utterly takes it out. So God wipes evil out when he decides to act. And all of this stuff then brings you to the cross, where God finally deals with sin. He deals with it with his son, and he does it in the death of Christ. And Christ doesn't sort of kind of die. Christ is destroyed. He is completely broken. This is why he says, like, this is my body broken for you, right? I mean, he is a broken figure at that point, and that all of the sin of the world is placed on Christ, and then Christ is destroyed, because when God deals with evil, he deals with it in totality. And so that's really what all this stuff points to. If you're trying to figure out what's going on in Jericho, you have to look at, like, well, this is what finally happens to Christ. And so also, when you try to figure out when is God going to deal with all this evil, one, he has dealt with all this evil in the person and work of Christ. And also, you don't want him dealing with evil outside of Christ, because he deals with it on every level. How would you like him to deal with evil? Just the evil that you don't like? When he deals with evil, he deals with it in the heart level, in the mind level. You know, he deals with it in the thinking level. If God decides to wipe out evil, we're going to be part of that destruction. So God isn't dealing with evil in that way, because he has dealt with evil fully and completely at the cross. And that's what all of these stories end up being. And that's why the destruction is so exhaustive.
That's a great way to end.
And that's it, man. That is it. That is 40 minutes. Guys, The Academy class that I did with Eric Sorensen is now available. So, you know, it's not too late to enroll, but it has launched. So the first session is up. If you want to get in on that, go over, and there's a link in the show notes. And you can sign up and take the life of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke with Eric and I. Also, Here We Still Stand. I know you probably can't go to that now because, you know, all the tickets are gone and you didn't get one. But maybe you wanted to be a part of it anyway. Well, I'll put a link in the show notes to the live stream so you can register for the live stream. It's free. You just sign up and then you'll get a notification when the conference goes live so you can watch the conference right there at home. Also, while you're over there, you know, clicking around at 1517, if you go to the donate page, you can become a supporter. That's what makes all this possible. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Chad, I will see you next week.
See you then. Thanks.